Recently, I did a Google search where I asked, what is the percentage of people that like mysteries? According to the AI overview response, approximately 64% reported enjoying the mystery genre, at least somewhat, indicating a large portion of populations enjoy mysteries. That is amazing information. What's available online? If I were planning to write a mystery novel, I could do some calculations to determine the maximum number of people that might be interested in reading my book. When I looked further down on the list of responses to my query, I noticed that the genres that most people like worldwide and what most people read are romance, classics, and poetry books. The Bible actually contains all of the genres listed. For many of us, the word genre may not be part of our normal vocabulary, not a word we normally use in our normal day-to-day conversations. It's not a word I normally use. For those that may not be familiar with the word genre, the definition from online Oxford Language Dictionary identifies the word as a noun. The dictionary defines genre as a category of artistic composition. They go on as in music or literature, characterized by similarities in style, form, or subject matter. For example, in music, you might have rap, pop, country, classical, big band. Those are all different genres of music. Mysteries, romance, classics, and poetry are different genres of literature. All of those genres of literature can be found in the Bible. For example, when I think of a romance in the Bible, my initial thought is Ruth, the book of Ruth. The book of Ruth is actually my favorite book. That might mean I might spend my time, if I had plenty of time, I'd spend my time reading novels. It'd probably be romance novels. I think not. What impresses me about the book of Ruth is the description of loyalty and faithfulness. Of course, for poetry, we might instinctively think of the Psalms. When it comes to classics, the entire Bible is considered by many to be the classic of classics. Some might even isolate the Psalms or Proverbs as the real classics within the Bible. If you'll turn over to Deuteronomy 29, one of the genres in the Bible that I often avoid are the mysteries. I think part of the reason is that I just read over the mysteries without meditating on them. Mysteries revealed are clues for our understanding of larger mysteries. Understanding mysteries requires observation and study of what is obvious or what we already know. For greater understanding, we take what is obvious and for greater understanding, we need to take what's obvious and dig a little deeper. With thought or meditations, and sometimes with experimentation, we can more clearly understand what in the beginning is a mystery or unknowable. In Deuteronomy 29 and verse 29, Deuteronomy 29, 29, the secret things belong to the Lord our God, but those things which are revealed belong to us and to our children forever, that we may do all the words of this law. Understanding the mysteries of God requires study and thought. Thought is meditation. Meditation is more focused thought. We know we must meditate on God's laws. As we meditate on God's laws, we will grow in understanding. What is mysterious or unknowable in the beginning will, with meditation, begin to be unraveled and therefore understood. The purpose of God's revelations and our meditation are that we will have understanding, gain wisdom, and do what God requires. God's revelations are for the purpose of motivating us to keep the law. We meditate and keep the law for our benefit. Please turn over to a familiar scripture. Please turn over to Romans 1. Some of what God uses for revealing mysteries are what he has created for our observation and study. As people observe and study the physical creation, God and many of his secrets are revealed. God's creation is an open book of revelation, encouraging us to study and research so that we may understand, respect, and love God. The study of science should motivate each of us to have a deep respect with heartfelt worship for the awesome nature of God and what he has created for us. Observation of the creation should motivate us toward pursuing righteous character. The way to salvation and righteous character are revealed through Christ by his message and example of living a perfect life without sin. In Romans 1, the Apostle Paul is explaining the good news of Christ. With revelation, the good news of Christ should be easily believed and understood if we honestly observe and evaluate the physical creation. What was once a mystery concerning Christ should be now understandable. Romans 1, and I want to start with verse 16. Romans 1, verse 16. For I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God to salvation for everyone who believes, for the Jew first, and also for the Greek. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. So God's righteousness was revealed in the life of Christ. And in continuing in verse 18, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Because although they knew, okay, so observation and scientific study reveals God. Those that study and honestly report on their research should know God through their study. So continuing in verse 21, because although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools. Scientific study of any of the many different aspects of the creation reveals God. Rejecting the obvious proofs of nature and God and his handiwork revealed in the physical universe brings on foolishness. By rejecting God, their minds and conclusions are perverted. If you'll turn over to Joshua, first chapter of Joshua, scientific research within the context of acknowledging the awesomeness of God's power and majesty bring prosperity or blessings with understanding and wisdom. In addition to observations of the physical creation, God also reveals additional information through his scriptures. We are to follow the examples in the Bible that lead to righteousness. One of those examples is that of of Joshua. Joshua 1 and verse 1. Joshua 1, verse 1. After the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord, it came to pass that the Lord spoke to Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' assistant. So the Lord, Jehovah here, is speaking to Joshua. Skipping down to verse 7, he commands Joshua to meditate on the book of the law. In verse 7, God speaking, "Only be strong and very courageous that you may observe to do all the law which Moses, my servant, commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right hand or to the left, that you may prosper wherever you go. This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate in it day and night, that you may observe to do according to all that is written in it. For then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have good success." God's instructions to Joshua also apply to us. Combining what can be observed and studied along with God's revelation through his laws and commandments brings prosperity and success. We should also meditate on the book of the law and the entire Bible. In addition, we must make observations of what can be seen. That includes what happens around us. Evil happens in this world. We will experience and witness evil. God expects us to learn from what we observe. If you'll turn over to Daniel 2, some things are secret and cannot be known unless they are revealed by the person that has the secret. In the book of Daniel, there is a story of a secret that only God could reveal. God revealed to King Nebuchadnezzar that he had a secret and that the king would not be able to figure it out. The king wouldn't understand the secret. So you may recall that King Nebuchadnezzar had a dream and he wanted to know what it meant. He realized that the dream was very significant and did not want to hear lying speculation of truth about the meaning. So he refused to tell anyone what he saw. He refused to tell anybody what he saw in that dream. So in Daniel 2, and I want to start in verse 2, Daniel 2, verse 2, "Then the king gave the command to call the magicians, the astrologers, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans to tell the king his dreams. So they came and stood before the king." So the magicians, the astrologers, the sorcerers, the Chaldeans could not tell the king, Nebuchadnezzar, what was the content of his dream. That was not good enough for the king. He threatened actually to exterminate all of them if they could not even reveal the content of his dream. So continuing in verse 5 of Daniel 2. "But the king answered and said to the Chaldeans, 'My decision is firm. If you do not make known the dream to me and its interpretation, you shall be cut in pieces and your houses will be made ash heaps.'" Comparing this to modern times, this could be a biblical example of a ruler's promise to clear the swamp of government incompetence and waste. His methodology seems a little extreme by our standards, but being dissatisfied with government workers is nothing new. In King Nebuchadnezzar's time, the government answered to the king. In this country, because we have our constitution, the government answers to the people through our elected representatives. The magicians, the astrologers, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans were there to advise the king concerning spiritual matters. Nebuchadnezzar realized that they were actually useless and only capable of lying about their knowledge of the spiritual matters concerning his dream. They acknowledged to the king that only if God revealed the dream could it be described and understood by anyone. Continuing in verse 10 of Daniel 2. Daniel 2, verse 10. "The Chaldeans answered the king and said, 'There is not a man on earth who can tell the king's matter. Therefore, no king, lord, or ruler has ever asked such a thing by any magicians, astrologer, or Chaldean.' Verse 11, it is a difficult thing that the king requires, and there is no other who can tell it to the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with the flesh. The meaning of the dream was a mystery. Revealing the content and meaning of the dream was beyond human ability. This was a mystery that where only God knew the secret. Only through revelation from God could the dream be understood. Let's continue in verse 12, Daniel 2. For this reason the king was angry and very furious, and he gave a command to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. So the decree went out, and they began killing the wise men, and they sought Daniel and his companions to kill them. Daniel understood that only God could reveal the mystery. He was able to plead with the king for a little more time so that he could appeal to God for the answer. Speaking of God, Daniel, in his prayer of thanksgiving to God for revealing the secret to him, said in verse 22, Daniel 2, verse 22, he reveals deep and secret things. He knows what is in the darkness, and light dwells with him. I thank you and praise you, O God of my fathers. You have given me wisdom and might and have made known to me what we asked of you, for you have made known to us the king's demand. So Daniel was going to be able to reveal the mystery of the dream to the king Nebuchadnezzar. When Daniel spoke to the king, he said in verse 27, Daniel 2, verse 27, so Daniel is now speaking to the king. He's presenting the answer. He said, Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, the secret which the king has demanded, the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, and the soothsayers cannot declare to the king. But there is a God in heaven who reveals secrets, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. Your dream and the visions of your head upon your bed were these. And as for you, O king, thoughts came to your mind while on your bed about what would come to pass after this. And he who reveals secrets has made known to you what will be. The secrets were revealed for information to the king and to show the supremacy of God. In Daniel 2 and verse 30. So Daniel is again speaking to Nebuchadnezzar. But as for me, this secret has not been revealed to me because I have more wisdom than anyone living. But for our sakes, who make known the interpretation to the king, that you may know the thoughts of your heart. So the revelation of this mystery of Nebuchadnezzar's dream is comparable to a game we have all played. We probably all likely played this game. The game is typically played by a person saying, I'm thinking of a number between 1 and 10. Guess the number. The number is a secret that can only be known by the person starting the game. Others can guess the number, but only the person asking the question knows the answer. The answer is a mystery until it is revealed. In the case of Daniel, the mystery could only be revealed by God. God blessed Daniel by revealing the secret to him. God revealed the secrets to Daniel for the purpose of revealing the mystery to King Nebuchadnezzar. The New Testament describes several mysteries as being revealed. In the New King James Version of the Bible, the word mystery is translated from the Greek 27 times. The primary Greek word translated as mystery is pronounced mysterion. It's Strong's number 3466. Now, I'm not a Greek scholar. Take the pronunciation for what it's worth. The word musterion was used 25 times in the New Testament, and it is translated every time. It translated mystery every time. The other two times the word mystery is translated from the Greek, it is translated from the Greek word pronounced mukterizo. Mukterizo is referenced by Strong's exhaustive concordance as Strong's number 3456. According to the Oxford Language Dictionary, a mystery is something that is difficult or impossible to explain. Merriam-Webster defines mystery as something not understood or beyond understanding. In other words, without further information, a mystery cannot be accurately understood. Impossible to understand without further information is what we saw in Daniel 2 with the example of Nebuchadnezzar's dream. The Bible is full of mysteries. Some mysteries are impossible to understand without further knowledge from God. For example, God created all things through his servant, the one who that became Jesus Christ. Without that revelation, that mystery would not be known. Some mysteries are difficult even when clues are revealed in the scriptures. Others can be understood through revealed instruction along with observation and scientific research. If you turn over to Deuteronomy 30. In the Old Testament, both the New King James and King James versions of the Bible, the word mystery is translated from the Hebrew into English only once. The Hebrew word is used 60 times, but is only translated once as mystery. The Hebrew word is pronounced pala and can be referenced by Strong's number 6381. The word in Hebrew is used to convey the meaning of something too hard, difficult, great, marvelous, or wonderful. In Deuteronomy chapters 29 and 30, Moses is exhorting the people to obey and keep the commandments. God had set before them in chapter 28 options of blessings, which would be the result of obeying God, or cursings. Curses are the penalties or punishments that are promised for disobedience. In chapter 30, Moses pleads with the children of Israel to choose life. In verse 19 of Deuteronomy 30, I call heaven and earth as a witness today against you, that I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore, choose life that both you and your descendants may live. Skipping back to verse 11, we see that what God is requiring of Israel was not something that was too hard for them. What he was commanding was not mysterious, was not so mysterious that they would not be able to understand his instructions. Deuteronomy 30, verse 11. For this commandment which I command you today, it is not too mysterious for you, nor is it too far off. It is not in heaven that you should say, who will ascend to heaven for us and bring it to us, that we may hear and do it? Nor is it beyond the sea that you should say, who will go over the sea for us and bring it to us, that we may hear and do it? But the word is very near you, in your mouth and in your heart, that you may do it. So through observation of the natural events of life, combined with God's revelation of his commandments, they and their descendants had enough information to understand God's expectations and to be able to choose life. There is a mystery that I suspect may be the most wondered about mystery in the Bible. The mystery, if not understood, can and does elicit a great deal of anger and hostility toward God. People often ask the question, why does God allow suffering? Often included with the question is the statement, if God is a loving God, then how can he be so cruel as to allow suffering? For many, this is a great mystery. For this mystery, the answers can be found in both the scriptures and from observation. From scriptures, we know that God created everything. He is the Father of humanity, loves us, and wants what is best for us. God created family for our benefit in understanding God. Parents of any society do not normally entertain themselves by torturing their children with pain and suffering. Most parents want what is best for their children. They want their children to be happy, grow up and be successful, and to have families of their own. In order to help their children, they are sometimes required to punish them in order to enhance their guidance to a quality life. We should be able to extrapolate from our observation of families with children that suffering likely has a purpose of improving our potential. I did a Google search asking the question, Bible reason for suffering. I got an AI overview response with two major categories. The AI overview stated, and by the way, AI is artificial intelligence. It's new technology that's being developed and being used more and more. So the AI overview stated, and I quote, according to the Bible, suffering is a result of human sin and living in a fallen world. Also, however, the Bible also says that suffering can have many purposes, including, and then they go through and list 9 different biblical purposes for suffering. So time is limited, so I'm only going to be able to cover the first category. So if you turn over to Judges 6, there is an example in the Bible of a man asking this same question. The man was Gideon. He was of the tribe of Manasseh. Gideon asked the question, my paraphrase, if God is a loving God, why does God allow all this suffering? Judges 6:13 describes Gideon's frustration with God as he questions him as to why. Judges 6:13, and Gideon said to him, O my Lord, if the Lord is with us, by the way, this is an individual that's sitting under a tree, and it's an angel. And Gideon said to him, O my Lord, if the Lord is with us, why then has all this happened to us? Where are all his miracles which our fathers told us about, saying, did not the Lord bring us up from Egypt? But now the Lord has forsaken us and delivered us into the hands of the Midianites. There can be no arguing against the fact that there is suffering in the world. People suffer horribly in hard times and even in good times. People face trials with both physical and emotional pain. Some trials are the result of sickness, accident, poverty, death, and can be based on many more causes. They occur in both good times and bad times. I have heard the question asked many times in my lifetime. This is a mystery that has not been understood by everyone over the course of human history. I think the question does deserve an answer. This is a question that, when left unanswered and not understood, can weaken the faith of even God's faithful. To set the stage, let's see what was happening to Israel at the time, that Gideon asked this question. Beginning in verse 1 of Judges 6, and the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, so the Lord delivered them into the hand of Midian for 7 years. First thing you notice is that Israel was doing evil. They were sinning and rebelling against God. Because they were doing evil, God allowed enemies to oppress them. As we will see, the Midianites were cruel, spirited, and made life for the Israelites miserable. In Judges 6, verse 2, and the hand of Midian prevailed against Israel because of the Midianites. The children of Israel made for themselves the dens, the caves, and the strongholds which are in the mountains. That's interesting. So to understand why they made the dens, caves, and strongholds in the mountains, let's look at 1 Samuel 13. The children of Israel were afraid of the Midianites. Because they were afraid, they hid themselves. A similar situation occurred in the time of Saul. Hold your place here in Judges, and let's turn over to 1 Samuel 13. 1 Samuel 13, this is another example of the Israelites being terrified, is when Saul, the new king of Israel, had reigned about 2 years in Israel, and he decided to push back against the Philistines who were oppressing the Israelites of his day. So beginning in verse 5 of 1 Samuel 13, then the Philistines gathered together to fight with Israel, 30,000 chariots and 6,000 horsemen, and people as the sand which is on the seashore in multitude. And they came up and encamped in Michmash to the east of Beth Aven. I cannot imagine the terror of seeing a military force so large in number as to be like the sands of the sea. In addition to being uncountable in mass of soldiers and support personnel, they were also supplemented with 30,000 chariots and 6,000 horsemen. They were a military force equipped with the latest technology available for destroying their enemies. For the Israelites, they could see that the likelihood that they would be totally annihilated was very possible. When the men of Israel, verse 6 of 1 Samuel 13, when the men of Israel saw that they were in danger, for the people were distressed, then the people hid in caves, in thickets, in rocks, in holes, and in pits. And some of the Hebrews crossed over the Jordan to the land of Gad and Gilead. In order to have a chance for survival, the people tried to find safe places to hide themselves. For those that were able to flee across the Jordan, they did so in order to put some distance from almost certain destruction. They fled and hid themselves for their own protection. Now back to Judges 6. Years before King Saul's time, the Israelites in the days of Gilead made dens, caves, and strongholds in the mountains for their protections. They had to protect themselves from starvation. The Midianites were trying to destroy Israel by starving them to death. Continuing in verse 3 of Judges 6. Judges 6, verse 3. So it was whenever Israel had sown, Midianites would come up. Also Amalekites and the people of the east would come up against them. Then they would encamp against them and destroy the produce of the earth as far as Gaza, and leave no substance for Israel, neither sheep nor ox or donkey. For they would come up with their livestock and their tents, and coming in as numerous as locusts, both they and their camels were without number, and they would enter the land to destroy it. God allowed Israel to suffer because of their sin and rebellion against his commandments. They did not think they needed God and thought that God would excuse them for their sins. Other nations were able to get away with their sins without God's intervening corrections. The difference with Israel is that they had covenanted with God to become an example to the world. Continuing in verse 6. So Israel was greatly impoverished because of the Midianites. And the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. Things had become so desperate that the people were crying out to God. They realized if they were to have any hope of survival as a nation, God would have to save them. That kind of introspection can often produce a change of attitude, an attitude of obedience to the God they were seeking to the God they were actually seeking help from. So God sent them a prophet to remind them of their covenant with him. That's in verse 7 of Judges 6. Judges 6, verse 7. And it came to pass when the children of Israel cried out to the Lord because of the Midianites, that the Lord sent a prophet to the children of Israel who said to them, "Thus says the Lord God of Israel, I brought you up from Egypt and brought you out of the house of bondage, and I delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians and out of the hand of all who oppressed you, and drove them out before you and gave you their land." So God is telling Israel through the prophet that he had already demonstrated his power to protect and save them. Nothing had changed with God. He was still able to protect and deliver Israel. The problem was that Israel had changed. They had wandered away from their obligation of faithfulness and respect toward God. Continuing in verse 10. "Also I said to you, I am the Lord your God. Do not fear the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But you have not obeyed my voice." So they no longer feared God. God had promised to protect them as long as they honored him as their God and obeyed his commandments. That is what they had covenanted to do. Israel had covenanted with God as recorded in Exodus chapter 19 through chapter 24. And that's where the Ten Commandments are recorded. They had promised to ratify the covenant in chapter 19. The covenant is presented to Israel as described in chapters 20 through 23. Then in chapter 24, Israel's ratification of the agreement with God is recorded. That covenant is summarized in 2 Kings chapter 17. So if you'll turn over to 2 Kings chapter 17, 2 Kings chapter 17. Chapter 17 of 2 Kings describes God banishing the 10 tribes of Israel from their land and allowing them to be carried off into captivity by the Assyrians. Chapter 17 describes the abominations that the tribes of Israel and Judah were guilty of. They were guilty of horrifying rituals such as destroying their children by burning them to death. They did this as a form of worship to pagan gods. 2 Kings chapter 17, verse 34. To this day, they continue practicing the former rituals. They do not fear the Lord, nor do they follow their statutes or their ordinances or the law and commandment which the Lord had commanded the children of Jacob, whom he named Israel. The former rituals were the rituals that God had commanded them not to do when he had covenanted with them. Continuing in verse 35, "with whom the Lord had made covenant and charged them, saying, you shall not fear other gods, nor bow down to them, nor serve them, nor sacrifice to them. But the Lord who brought you up from the land of Egypt with great power and an outstretched arm, him you shall fear, him you shall worship, and to him you shall offer sacrifice. And the statutes and the ordinances of the law and the commandment which he wrote for you, you shall be careful to observe forever. You shall not fear other gods, and the covenant that I have made with you, you shall not forget, nor shall you fear other gods. But the Lord your God you shall fear, and he will deliver you from the hand of all your enemies." However, they did not obey, but they followed their former rituals. The result of Israel being carried off into captivity meant that even to this day, the nation of Israel has not been returned to their heritage, to the heritage of land that God had promised them as long as they obeyed him. They were carried off because of their sins. God repeatedly sent prophets to warn Israel, to explain to them what God expected of them. Look back in this chapter, verse 13. 2 Kings chapter 17 and verse 13. Yet the Lord testified against Israel and against Judah by all of his prophets, namely every seer, saying, turn from your evil ways and keep my commandments and my statutes according to all the law which I commanded your fathers and which I sent to you by my servants, the prophets. Nevertheless, they would not hear, but stiffened their necks like the necks of their fathers who did not believe in the Lord their God. They rejected his statutes and his covenants that he had made with their fathers and his testimonies which he had testified against them. They followed idols, became idolaters, and went after the nations who were all around them concerning whom the Lord had charged them that they should not do like them. So they left all the commandments of the Lord their God, made for themselves a molded image and took and two calves, made a wooden image, and worshipped all the hosts of heaven and served Baal. And they caused their sons and daughters to pass through fire, practiced witchcraft and soothsaying, and sold themselves to do evil in the sight of the Lord to provoke him to anger. Therefore the Lord was very angry with Israel and removed them from his sight, and there was none left but the tribe of Judah alone. They were banished from the land because of their sins. In verse 6 of this chapter describes where Israel was relocated to. And starting with verse 5, now the king of Assyria went throughout all the land and went up to Samaria and besieged it for 3 years. So for 3 years, the nation of Israel had to suffer under the oppression of war and all the fear and anguish that are the consequences of war. 2 Kings 17, verse 6, in the ninth year of Hoshea, now Hoshea was a king of Israel, Shalmaneser was the king of Assyria. Continuing in verse 5, so the king of Assyria took Samaria and carried Israel away to Assyria and placed them in Halah and by the Habor, the river of Gozan, and in the cities of the Medes. So why did God allow that to happen to Israel? Continuing in verse 7. For so it was that the children of Israel had sinned against the Lord their God, who had brought them up out of the land of Egypt from under the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and they had feared other gods and had walked in the statutes of the nations whom the Lord had cast out from before the children of Israel and the kings of Israel, which they had made. So let's skip down to verse 20. And the Lord rejected all the descendants of Israel, afflicted them, and delivered them into the hand of the plunderers until he had cast them from his sight. And remember here, we are speaking of Israel. We're not speaking of Judah in this particular case. He tore Israel from the house of David, and they made Jeroboam the son of Nebat king. Then Jeroboam drove Israel from following the Lord and made them commit a great sin. Verse 22, for the children of Israel walked in all the sins of Jeroboam, which he did, and they did not depart from them until the Lord removed Israel out of his sight, as he had said, by all his servants the prophets. So Israel was carried away from their own land to Assyria as it is to this day. Even to this day, the 10 lost tribes of Israel have not returned to their own land. The Jews have returned, but as we saw in verse 21, Israel and Judah were separate nations. Israel was carried away, but Judah remained. Turn back to Judges 6. With this background information of what are God's expectations, we can go back to Judges 6, where Gideon asked the question, my paraphrase, if God is a loving God, why does he allow all this suffering? We've already read in verse 8, where God had sent a prophet to Israel explaining to them that sin was the reason they were being oppressed. Now in verse 11, we are introduced to the presence of an angel being sent to Gideon. The prophet in verse 8 was not an angel. The angel introduced in verses 11 and 12 is a spirit being. Beginning in verse 12, Judges 6, verse 12. And the angel of the Lord, this is the angel of Jehovah, appeared to him and said to him, "The Lord," and this is the Lord Jehovah, "is with you, you mighty man of valor." The angel of the Lord is a spirit being. He appears and announces to Gideon that he, Gideon, is in the presence of Jehovah. Judging from Gideon's response, I don't think it registered with him that Jehovah was there. In verse 13, and Gideon said to him, "O my Lord." Now notice, Gideon addresses the angel as his Lord. The word used is Strong's number 113, pronounced Adon. The word means a sovereign, either human or spirit. This angel is likely the one that became Jesus. Continuing in verse 13, Gideon is asking in a somewhat accusatory manner, "If the Lord is with us, why then has all this happened to us? And where are all his miracles which our fathers told us about, saying, 'Did not the Lord bring us up from Egypt?' But now the Lord has forsaken us and delivered us into the hand of the Midianites." The Lord here is Jehovah, meaning Almighty God, our Father in heaven. Gideon is questioning the angel as to why Jehovah had abandoned Israel. The answer he got did not come from the angel. God Almighty, Jehovah himself, responded to Gideon. Verse 14. Then the Lord, Jehovah, turned to him and said, "Go in this might of yours, and you shall save Israel from the hand of the Midianites. Have I not sent you?" Notice this is God speaking directly to Gideon. It is not the angel, but of God speaking. I read a little sarcasm in God's statement. "Go in this might of yours." I don't think it had sunk in yet to Gideon that he was actually talking to God and in the presence of God. If he were speaking to one of the rulers of the Midianites, I'm sure he would have more quickly recognized the danger that he was confronting of someone of greater power than him. Most any man, even one that thought of himself as powerful, would have been a little more careful with his words in verse 13. Gideon's response to God in verse 15. In verse 15, here's Gideon's response to God in verse 15. So he said to him, "O my Lord," now he's a little more respectful. So he's asking the question, "O my Lord, how can I save Israel? Indeed, my clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my father's house." The Hebrew word translated "my Lord" here in verse 15 is different from "my Lord" in verse 13. Here the word, according to the notes in my desktop computer Bible software, is used exclusively for God. The word here is Strong's number 0136, pronounced Adonai. Again, I'm not a Hebrew scholar or a Greek scholar, so. The angel is still present, but the conversation is between God and Gideon. God, Jehovah, then responded to Gideon's question in verse 16. Verse 16, and the Lord, This is the Lord, here is Jehovah, said to him, surely I will be with you, and you shall defeat the Midianites as one man. Can you imagine the range of emotions that Gideon was likely going through? First, he starts off speaking to the angel with a contemptuous question that was accusatory toward God. Then God himself responds with a little sarcasm of his own. The next verse, Gideon shows less confidence, but he's not absolutely sure who he's speaking to. The angel is still there, but the angel is not speaking. Jehovah is speaking directly to Gideon. Gideon hears God. I would assume he does not see him and is beginning to show a little concern. He's still not sure he's speaking to Jehovah. In verse 17, then he said to him, so Gideon is speaking to God, if now I have found favor in your sight, then show me a sign that it is you who talk with me. Verse 18, do not depart from here, I pray. In other words, please don't leave until I come back to you and bring out my offerings and set it before you. And he, Jehovah, said, I will wait until you come back. Gideon went and prepared an offering and brought it back. Then the angel of the Lord instructed Gideon on how to present the offering to God. And continuing in verse 21, then the angel of the Lord put out the end of the staff that was in his hand and touched the meat and the unleavened bread, and fire rose out of the rock and consumed the meat and the unleavened bread, and the angel of the Lord departed out of his sight. At this point in the story, the angel leaves. The scene is no longer involved. The scene is no longer involved. Excuse me. The angel leaves. He leaves the scene, and the angel from that point on is no longer involved in this story. The next verse, God and Gideon discuss the angel. Gideon is afraid that he might die for seeing the angel. In verse 22, now Gideon perceived that he was the angel of the Lord. So Gideon said, alas, O Lord God, for I have seen the angel of the Lord face to face. Then the Lord, this is Jehovah, said to him, peace be with you, do not fear, you shall not die. The rest of the story involves God's personal involvement in delivering Israel from the oppression and suffering they were experiencing from the Midianites. Gideon recruited 32,000 people to fight against the Midianites. God could have destroyed the Midianites without the children of Israel being involved. He did not. God required the children of Israel to be involved. Gideon's army came out, and they witnessed the massive army of the Midianites. 22,000 of the army had to admit, so this is the people that came out to help Gideon, so 22,000 of his people had to admit that they were afraid of the Midianites. And God told Gideon to send them home. Of the 10,000 left, God tested them and chose only 300 men. Looking at the next chapter, chapter 7 and verse 7. So it should be chapter 7, just a page over. Then the Lord said to Gideon, by the 300 men who lapped, and that's with how they drank the water, I will save you and deliver the Midianites into your hand. Let all the other people go, every man to his place. The people of Israel had had to do nothing. There would have been very little gain in teaching them and impacting their attitude toward obeying God. 32,000 people of Israel were gathered as witness to the might of the Midianite army. Then they were witness to the fact that God delivered Israel using only 300 men. Only God could perform such a miracle. God demonstrated his love and tenderness toward Israel by punishing them for their sins. Their punishment was the 7 years of suffering under the oppression of the Midianites. Then, much like a father that has to correct his child, he comforts them. God protected Israel from further harm. The punishment was done. He used 300 men to miraculously deliver Israel and defeat the Midianites, their oppressors. If you turn over to Romans chapter 8. Suffering is designed to be a training tool to teach all of humanity lessons we will need to know and understand for eternity. In the similar way that a parent corrects a child, sometimes through punishment, so that they will grow up and be productive adults, God also corrects. Sometimes he uses punishment and suffering as training tools. God's thoughts and goals are long-term. Romans 8, I'm going to read verse 18 of Romans 8. For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. We are being prepared for a glorious future that is so wonderful it is beyond the bounds of our imagination. For that we can be thankful that God cares for us and is willing to take the time for each of us to receive what we need to grow to a mature child of God. Continuing in verse 19. For the earnest expectation of the creation eagerly awaits for the revealing of the sons of God. And skipping to verse 21, because the creation itself also will be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God. By observing the many principles of what we experience in suffering and challenges during this life, we can extrapolate an expectation of wonderful opportunities and challenges throughout eternity. We are being conditioned to overcome challenges. The AI overview, artificial intelligence, that I mentioned earlier first listed suffering as the punishment for sin. But as we have seen, that punishment is for our admonition and benefit. We grow and become stronger when we are challenged. The second reason for suffering had 9 subpoints. All of the subpoints were for producing positive outcomes toward the goal of maturity. According to the AI review, I quote, the Bible also recognizes that suffering can come in many different forms, including mental, physical, emotional, and spiritual. Perhaps they can be a topic for a future sermon. We have an awesome future that is a mystery to most of humanity. The mystery of suffering can be understood by a combination of observation and revelation from God. When we see suffering in others or experience suffering ourselves, we can take consolation in our understanding of the mystery of suffering.